Well, this is setting up because not being a technical person, I immediately shut down my computer when I was supposed to be starting the presentation. I'd like to thank Anders Jansson very much for inviting me to Sweden, and I'm delighted to be sharing a platform with Catherine Rainier and also with Thomas Nostrum. I have never been to Sweden before, and it's always been a place of fascination for me as a lifelong ABBA fan. And also my house bears witness to the fact that I shop a lot at IKEA. But of course, in recent months, there has been a brand new export from Sweden to the UK, for which we are very, very grateful. And that is, of course, the new England football manager, Sven-Göran Eriksson. All I would like to say to you is thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It will take a while for me to find my slides, but I'm going to be speaking to you today about the experience that we have had in .UK. We are the second largest country code top-level domain, second only to Germany. We have 3 million domain name registrations on our database. And we have had for some years been experiencing the issues that arise from operating an open first come first served registry. I'm aware from speaking with Anders that the Swedish registry is in the position of considering whether or not to liberalise its rules. And I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you're planning to move from a situation of great control at the point of registration to perhaps lifting that control and are in the process of thinking, well, how far do we lift the control and what happens if we do? We sort of took the plunge of doing that in 1996 when Nominet was formed. And we went from a very similar system of pre-vetting, one domain name per company, company name had to be a reasonable variant on the domain name, to completely opening the doors and saying, right, okay, anything goes. Right, finally got my slides. Sorry about the delay. I'm going to describe, I know that this is primarily a technical conference, and that I assume I'm not speaking to an audience of lawyers. Is that correct? I don't know how many of you are lawyers. Unfortunately, I will be going into a little bit of the detail, the nitty-gritty of what our policy actually is, but more the purpose of the talk is to give an overview of what our procedure is and the sort of process that we have undertaken for the last year and a half in changing our procedures. Right, first of all, Sven, just thought we'd all like to... Thank you, Sven. Nominet has actually been operating a dispute resolution service since 1997, and we were one of the first providers of an alternative dispute resolution forum for domain name disputes. Since 1997, when we opened our doors to disputes, we have handled 1,500 cases. I'd just like to dwell on that figure very briefly. In the context of 3 million domain name registrations, that does not even hit 0.1%. It's actually half of 0.1%. One in 2,000 domain names on the register lead to a dispute. And for me, that is a figure which I draw comfort from, because although it may seem that operating a first-come, first-served registry can seem absurdly irresponsible and random, in fact, and our experience is borne out by the sort of statistics that WIPO have experienced, a very, very small percentage of the total domain names on the register lead to a dispute. Having said that, it is important to handle those in an efficient and effective manner because they are really important for the participants. Under the original service that was in operation until September this year, we would have written submissions from the parties, and then we would kick in an informal mediation process, which took place by telephone. If mediation was not successful, then Nominet would take a decision. The registry itself would make a decision on the rights of the parties by applying its own rules. And if the parties were not happy with the outcome, they could appeal to an independent expert, of which we carried a panel of 12 or so. Some little more detail on the original service. We were able to resolve 30% of all cases through mediation. And that, bear in mind, is in the context of a service which published no decisions, no guidelines, and no procedures. And so it was very difficult for those who came into the service to be able to predict with any certainty the likely outcome of a decision. So we're quite proud of that figure, and we think that there is scope for it to improve. Under our old rules, there were 5 grounds on which Nominet could act to cancel or suspend a domain name. Suspension is our term for just removing the domain name, the name servers from the domain name record, or no longer pointing to them. So the registration remains on the register, but it is useless. The most commonly relied on ground in practice is where it is brought to Nominet's attention that the domain name is being used in a manner likely to cause confusion to internet users. So you have in that 2 concepts, use and likelihood of confusion. And bear in mind, this is on a paper-based system where you have no opportunity to test by talking to the people what the veracity of their claims is. This is a highly discretionary and wide-ranging ground with very little guidance for people on how we would decide. And generally speaking, our process, as it was not transparent. So in around April last year, we set about trying to review the service almost from scratch. And our principal aim, was to provide an alternative dispute resolution service to match the speed and ease of registration. Well, of course, that is inherently unachievable. In a system where you can register a domain name in a matter of seconds, you can obviously not hope to resolve disputes in a similar time frame. But bearing in mind, speaking with Anders shortly before this talk, he was describing a case in which he is involved, which is likely to take 3 years to come to a final court decision. In a system where a registry is offering registration of domain names in minutes or seconds, in our view, it was not acceptable to say, go off to court and take the years that it will involve and the hundreds of thousands of pounds that it will involve you spending. We wanted a low-cost, quick, transparent service, and overall, to safeguard our first-come, first-served system. Before we started to review our old dispute resolution service, there was a sort of bubble of discontent, a growing groundswell from large companies based in the UK who were saying, we are suffering from, our name is being registered by people abusively, you don't seem to be able to tackle it in an efficient way, and we think what you should do is operate a control, a pre-examination system before registering. So going back to the model that is currently operated in Sweden and was operated in the UK until 1995-96. We register at the current time 60,000 new domain names a month, and last year we peaked at 250,000 in the month of March. And so for us, the operational consequences of pre-examination would be absolutely devastating. And in our view, when you have the choice of registering in .com in seconds or going through a lengthy pre-examination process in .uk, we know that most people would vote with their feet. We wanted to continue to resolve cases through mediation which has been successful. And as Anders said, we believe that we are unique in offering this service in the context of domain name disputes. And we wanted to restrict ourselves to clear cases of abuse. We recognise from our own real-world experience that a paper-based, primarily administrative system is not actually geared up to deal with conflicts of fact or cases where the parties have competing rights. The obvious choice for us to make was to adopt the UDRP, so why didn't we do it? Well, first, as I've emphasised, we were quite pleased with our results through mediation. And mediation in the UK, as Anders said in his introduction, is becoming more and more part of the litigation box of tools, if you like. It's something that the courts very much encourage, and that we see our services sitting within the framework of the whole court ethos at the moment. As Catherine has described in some detail, the UDRP is an international solution for generic top-level domains. And I know that WIPO has done a great deal of work to ensure, for instance, a proper representation on its panel of experts from the different countries to deal with multilingual disputes and to draw in the international community. Well, that is absolutely the solution that must be drawn to a generic top-level domain, which is international in its very essence. A country code top-level domain, by definition, has a national identity, a location. And although there are a great many strengths in the UDRP from its internationalism, we perceived, in our view, that there were also some downsides. For instance, we could see that the panelists, of course, apply their own experience and their own legal principles to the UDRP rules. And as a result, some inconsistencies have crept in. Of course, any system has inconsistencies, but we asked, well, is that something that we could avoid? As Catherine has said, it is based on trademark rights. And in 80% of cases, the trademark holder wins. Rightly or wrongly, and I think I don't have a strong view on this, there is a view in the UK internet community that the UDRP is trademark friendly, that if you have a trademark, you will win. In my view, there is a sort of pre-selection involved there, because if you don't have a trademark, you probably won't even need to go to the UDRP or believe that it's one of your options. But also, we felt that we had an existing infrastructure, we had staff who were trained and able to deal with disputes, and we had always viewed dispute resolution as part of the registry core functions, aside from its the technical functions that are, of course, vital. We also viewed dispute resolution as sitting back-to-back with providing an open, first-come, first-served service. In our new policy, we wanted... There were some overriding principles, increased transparency, and for that reason we have published a policy and a procedure which tells people how long it will take, how long they've got to do the next step, and the sort of pattern, what will happen next, so that they can assess things at the outset. We also will be publishing decisions in full, and we've developed online forms to assist parties, particularly those who don't have the benefit of legal representation. I know it's that this is not a party of lawyers, so please forgive me for going into the text of the policy itself, but I will try and be brief. Basically, to succeed in getting a transfer or cancellation or suspension of a domain name in dispute, the complainant, the person bringing the case to us, must show two things. Firstly, that they have rights in respect of a name or mark which is identical or similar to the domain name. And secondly, that the domain name in the hands of the respondent is an abusive registration. I just want to focus on a couple of issues of that. An abusive registration, you will note that the term bad faith does not appear in this definition. And that was felt, it was felt that the term bad faith carries with it sort of a moral judgment almost, which I don't believe is the intention. And some respondents, I know speaking to some UDRP panellists, have got extremely cross about being found to have registered in bad faith and threatened to sue them for defamation. Whereas in fact, under the UDRP, what you have is a pretty objective test. Have the following things happened? Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And this is not actually a moral judgment. So what is it that the policy wants to prevent? Well, it is. There are two things. There's the concept of unfair advantage, riding on the back of someone else's reputation and success. And then the converse of that is unfairly doing them down, using their name to, say, draw traffic or whatever, and to unfairly, you know, divert their trade or to be detrimental to them in some way. So you've got this dual concept, unfair advantage, unfair detriment. And as Catherine pointed out, we felt that to insist on both registration and use satisfying this test was too steep, because in many, many, many cases of what we would term cyber-squatting, there is not what we would call use at all of the domain name. It's sitting there on the register. So we've got registration or use in a way that is unfair advantage or unfairly detrimental. So what are the rights that need to be asserted? Well, we had never drawn a distinction in our previous service between, you know, you have to have a trademark or you have to have trading rights of some sort. It was just completely open. And although, again, that seems slightly bizarre, we've come from a different tradition. In practice, people assert all sorts of rights. Yes, you have registered trademarks. We have the rights that would, in the UK, give rise to an action for passing off, which is a sort of unfair competition law, for unregistered rights. But I'm aware that in a country such as Sweden, you recognise that one can have rights in a trading name, but which would not necessarily be registered as a mark. Also, where do personal names fit in? Well, in the UK, we don't actually have personality rights as such, but the courts have applied protection for personal names in certain contexts. So we did not want to restrict ourselves to a certain bundle of rights. The intention was that it should be a low threshold for entry into the system, because the real purpose of the system is to avoid abusive registrations and not to prevent people who do not happen to have a registered right from trying to combat such abuse. We deal with the burden of proof. It is the complainant who must prove both elements are true. And the standard of proof is that found in our domestic civil courts, the balance of probability. So you just over 50%. The policy sets out examples of the sort of things that would be considered abusive. An offer for sale in excess of documented out-of-pocket expenses, i.e. sale for profit. That's the kind of archetypal classic cyber-squatting example. Also, a blocking registration, where we've come across this on a small scale with small companies where there's been a fallout, people have left the company, realised that the company hasn't registered its domain name, registered it and then said, you can't have it, I don't want money, I just don't want you to have it. It's that sort of situation. And then there are more general sort of sweeping up things, disruption of business, actual confusion, which is a higher threshold than our previous test, and that is because of our experience under our previous test, where in this paper-based system, to deal with a matter of likelihood of confusion is extremely difficult. There's also things like a pattern of conduct. Is this person someone who has, you know, done this before. Oh, look at all the domain names they register and all the famous names that there are. The provision of false contact details, that was something that came out in our consultation process. That was felt to be an indicator of potential abuse. But importantly, failure to use the name is not in itself enough. A strong body of opinion, particularly from large corporate bodies, international organisations and trademark holders, felt that if you don't use the domain name, you should lose it. But we felt no, because there are a number of very good reasons why you might want a domain name, but you might not use it. You may not have got it together yet to put your website or your email function up. You may be developing a new product, a new line, a new company name that you just don't want someone else to register. So there are an enormous number of legitimate reasons why you may not want to use a domain name. Well, under this two-stage test, the respondent, the holder of the domain name, is given the opportunity to defend themselves, and we set out a number of defences. Yeah, a genuine offering of goods and services, commonly known by or legitimately connected with the name, non-commercial or fair use, the sort of tribute protest site scenario, or the name itself is completely generic, descriptive, you know, no one can have rights in it. We have dealt in the policy specifically with the issue of tribute and protest sites. Again, this was an area where we perceived that sensible people can diverge in their views very, very widely. There's a strong lobby that believe fervently that the internet is a forum in which people can and should exercise freedom of speech. They should be able to have their gripe sites about companies that they think are not behaving properly, and they should also be able to put their little fan sites up. So we felt, well, fair enough, that is fair enough, but using the identical name of the complainant is something different. And if you're doing that without authority and you're using it for a tribute or protest site, then the burden shifts to the holder of the domain name to show that that there is a justification for it. I'm just going to quickly rattle through the procedure and also the steps that we took in revising our service. An overview, there are written submissions by the parties. One thing to note is that the complainant has the right to reply once they've heard from the respondent. Then informal mediation will kick in, obviously only if the respondent does put in a submission, because otherwise you can't really mediate with one party. If mediation is not successful, then and only then will the complainant be invited to pay a fee for the dispute to go further. So everything until that stage is provided free of charge. An expert would be appointed on payment of a fee and issue a decision within 10 working days. And there is also a right of appeal. Mediation, as I've said, is conducted informally by telephone. It times out after 10 working days. So if it's not successful then the decision can be made. But the mediation process is itself without prejudice and confidential. In other words, the expert will not know any of the proceedings that have gone on during mediation. And they will only be told that mediation has either not been attempted in a no response case or has failed. The experts need to be impartial, independent of nominate. We felt very strongly under the old service that nominate should not be making decisions about the rights of parties. We are going to operate a cab rank situation where the next available expert takes the next case, subject to conflicts of interest and general availability. The expert's decision, I should say that the initial decisions will be taken by a single expert. There will not be an option to appoint a panel of three. The decision will be a standalone document. By reading the decision, you will know the facts of the case, what the parties said, and the general procedural history. And they'll be published in full on our website. and unless exceptional circumstances apply, the decision will be based just on reading the documents. There will be a right of appeal on payment of £3,000 to a three-person panel. The appeal decisions will be kept in a separate area of the website and will be expected to carry more authority. Nominet also has the right to bring certain questions of interpretation to the appeal panel for guidance, particularly if we see that there's a divergence in the first instance decisions. So this is a sort of graphical representation of how we saw our dispute resolution service operating. I thought it may be interesting to just share with you the history of the last 18 months or so since we first decided in earnest to change our system. The first crucial months from April to December 2000 were spent in building consensus internally, convincing those within the registry and key stakeholders that something needed to change. And we were helped in this by the fact that around that time, with the emergence of the UDRP as a great success in resolving domain name disputes through an administrative procedure, there was a groundswell of support for changing the system. We had meetings with stakeholders and drew up some initial documents. Then in January, we went public and launched a public consultation. So we published these documents on our website and invited comments, which again, we published. We went on the road, did lots of meetings with interested parties, the internet community, the legal community, and tried to get our messaging across to draw debate and to find out what people thought about it. And we published the feedback on our website. And then, of course, if you're encouraging feedback, you have to do something about it. So we then spent from April to July assessing the feedback, feeding it into the documents, and going back to our policy advisory board, which is built up of different representatives of stakeholders within the internet community, sharing it with them, building consensus again, and then getting board approval. So there we are in July. Let's start the service in September. So between August and the 24th of September, we started advertising in earnest for experts, recruiting staff, and developing the vital database and website support for the new service. We are going from a system where everything is discretionary, there are no time limits whatsoever, and we can just decide ad hoc what to do, to a system which is regimented, driven by dates, and so we have developed a database which prompts us for outstanding tasks and generates the standard letters, and so can gear up to a high level of disputes. This was the advertisement that we placed. We did a national advertising campaign for experts and drew 750 applicants, which all had to be dealt with by our staff. So on the 24th of September, we launched a new service. We gave out information to stakeholders and the media, and we had in place technical backup, the online forms, the website support, the database. And in our first 2 weeks, we have received 18 complaints. So it remains to be seen how the service operates in practice. I think the things that I would share with you are: when you change a system, it is a lengthy process, and it is necessarily lengthy because change involves building consensus. When you have a national resource, when you're the trustee of a national resource, as Nominet views itself in the UK. If you'd like further information, then it can be found on our website, nominet.org.uk/drs.html. Thank you for your attention.